This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my blessing to be in dialogue with Paula Tartikoff. She is a full professor in the Department of History and the Department of Jewish Studies at Rutgers University, where she is also the chair of the Department of Jewish Studies. Today, we will be discussing her book, which has just come out in paperback this year in 2024, Between Christian and Jew, Conversion in the Crown of Aragon, 1250 to 1391, published in Philadelphia by University of Pennsylvania Press, first edition 2012, and the paperback edition 2024. Paula, thank you for being with us today. I'm so grateful.
Thank you so much, Ari. It's really a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
To begin, can you tell us about your path to becoming a historian?
Sure. So I guess, like for all historians, it's a long path with many different contributing factors. For as long as I can remember, I've loved reading historical fiction, thinking about the past, studying history, doing research, writing reports. I remember as a young child, lying in bed at night, trying to go to sleep by imagining what my life would have been like, you know, in the places where my ancestors lived, one century ago, 2 centuries ago, 3 centuries ago. So I was always sort of steeped in through what I read and what I thought about in history. And I had the good fortune as a child and as an adolescent to live in Europe for extended periods of time with my family, where I was exposed to the Middle Ages in a way that one just isn't in the United States, because one isn't surrounded by the architecture and other artifacts from that period in the past, hundreds of years ago. And so coming back to the United States with a love for all, you know, or many aspects of medieval culture, I wanted to study it more and learn more about the things I had seen and learned about in Europe. So in college at Harvard University, I majored in history, and I wrote a honors thesis with Professor Thomas Bisson, who's a specialist in the history of medieval Catalonia. My thesis was on the Jewish-Christian disputations of Paris in 1240 and Barcelona in 1263. And one thing led to another. I went to graduate school at Columbia University, where I focused on history. And I had, again, the great good fortune of having wonderful, generous mentors who were very demanding and very supportive and present and really taught through example. And they included Carolyn Walker Bynum, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, Adam Costo, and others. And long story short, I was hired at Rutgers University, where, as you mentioned, I have this joint appointment in the departments of history and Jewish studies. And something else that has been really instrumental in my path as a historian has been the good fortune and privilege of receiving support from a wide variety of fellowships, including Fulbright, National Endowment for the Humanities, the Israel Institute for Advanced Studies in Jerusalem, European Institutes for Advanced Study, the Katz Center for Advanced Jewish Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And these not only gave me time off from teaching, but they also brought me into contact with wonderful groups of scholars I wouldn't have met with otherwise, especially in cases where the fellowship was residential, and broadened my networks and broadened my thinking in ways that are truly invaluable.
What inspired you to write this book?
So I went on a fishing expedition, as my advisors called it, after I finished my oral examinations in graduate school. I went on this fishing expedition looking for archival sources in northeastern Spain to see what I would find available that I could potentially work on for my dissertation. And in Barcelona, in the archive of the Cathedral of Barcelona, which is a tiny room on the roof of the cathedral behind the bell tower, I requested a very large leather codex, which was an inquisitorial dossier of a trial that took place in 1340 and 1341. And I had read about this trial in the footnotes and an article by a wonderful Catalan historian, Josep Perenau I Espelt, but this dossier had not been published. And I was astonished as I read more about it and handled the physical object and flooded with questions, because one typically thinks of the Inquisition, especially in the context of Jewish studies, as an institution that was established in 1478, began to function in 1480, which is on the eve of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain at a time when there are thousands of Jewish converts in what is now Spain. And here we were over 100 years earlier, 150 years earlier. The contents of this dossier had to do with the inquisitorial prosecution of Jewish converts and unbaptized Jews. So this was perplexing and intriguing. This is the papal Inquisition we're talking about here, which is the institutional predecessor to the Spanish Inquisition. The papal Inquisition was founded in the 1230s, specifically to combat Christian heresy. So I was curious as to why it was engaged in Jewish affairs in this case, whether there were other instances in which it had been engaged in Jewish affairs. And I was especially curious as to why not only baptized Jews, who fell squarely within the Inquisition's jurisdiction because they were Christians formally, because they were baptized, not only them, but also unbaptized Jews in this particular trial were prosecuted by inquisitors. And what was even more extraordinary, to wrap up what's becoming a long answer to your question, is the specific story of this case. We open in the middle of a dramatic scene where a young man who has converted from Judaism to Christianity, whose name is Pere, that's his Christian name, which is Peter in Catalan. His Jewish name was Eleazar, is beginning to be burned at the stake in the center of the town of Calatayud in Aragon. The flames are lapping at his feet. The smoke is wafting up around his body. And the local Dominican prior and an inquisitor rush onto the scene and demand that he be unbound from the pyre and taken down because they want to interrogate him. And what has happened is they have heard that this Jewish convert was put up to becoming a Jewish martyr, renouncing Christianity and becoming a Jewish martyr by Jews, that there are local Jews who are encouraging Jewish converts to Christianity, to renounce Christianity, and voluntarily die at the stake to atone for their sins. That's the Latin and Catalan sort of version of what we get in the inquisitorial dossier in terms of the language. And so we also learn early on that 7 years earlier, the same thing had happened in this town, but a Jewish convert named Avadia had actually burned to death after allegedly Jews had convinced him to renounce Christianity and do so to save his soul. So I not only now had questions about the relationship between the papal inquisition and Jewish communities and Jewish conversion 150 years before the period that has greatly overshadowed the 14th century and earlier 13th century, but in terms of inquisitorial prosecution of these groups. But I also wanted to know, who were these two men who had converted to Judaism during a period when we don't tend to think of Jewish conversion as sort of a very important phenomenon? We tend to think of 1391 as a big turning point, a watershed moment in the history of Jewish conversion, when across Iberia we have mass violent conversions of Jews to Christianity. Why did they convert to Christianity? Did Jews actually sort of intervene and not only try to convince them to return to Judaism, but try to get them to court martyrdom to atone for their sins? Each part of this was raising questions for me. And so I decided to take this story, analyze the entire trial to see how it unfolded, and also learn about these broader contexts about which it raised questions. And that became the first version of what would become this book, which was my dissertation.
What are the primary themes in your book? What story and stories does your book tell?
Right. So the primary themes, there are three, which correspond to the three parts of the book. One is the inquisitorial prosecution of Jews and Jewish converts by the papal inquisition, so during the late 13th and 14th centuries. The second theme would be Jewish conversions prior to 1391. Who was converting? Why? And then the third part or theme has to do with the return to Judaism of quite a few Jewish converts and what that looked like socially and ideologically for converts, Christians, and Jews. So the backbone of the book is the story of Pera, and each of the three sections of the book consists of two chapters, and those two chapters are each framed by a little bit more of Pera's story, which then I unpack the contexts for, you know, in the intervening chapters. And so I'm telling on the one hand this story of what happened to this young man who otherwise we would never know of historically. And then at the same time, I'm telling much broader stories about what we could think of as the prehistory of the Inquisition, sort of the prehistory of what we used to think of as the period of Jewish conversion in Spain, and also the story of the fates of Jewish converts, many of whom tried to return to Judaism.
What is your book's contribution to the academic study of conversion?
Thank you for this question. So I would say that the book broadens the lens through which we consider the social history of medieval Jewish conversion in several ways. One is understanding its chronology, as I've already mentioned. Jews were converting to Christianity in Spain long before 1391, not in huge numbers, I would say in a trickle, but this trickle is important to know about and investigate. Secondly, my book is zeroing in on the nature of Jewish conversion during this period prior to 1391, and it's complicating what I think is commonly thought of as a dichotomy between forced conversion on the one hand and voluntary conversion on the other. It's showing that there were many shades of gray, if you will. And it's also overturning a narrative in which, when we did think about Jewish converts in Spain and Europe pre-1391, the figures who came to mind tended to be lone male polemicists, anti-Jewish polemicists. One might think of Nicholas Donin, who was the Christian disputant. He was a Jewish convert to Christianity who served as the Christian disputant at the Paris Disputation of 1240, or Pablo Cristiani, again, a Jewish convert, became a Dominican, served as the Christian disputant at the Barcelona Disputation of 1263. But the converts who emerged in my research were men, women, children, families, small groups, and they converted neither at sword's point, nor, as far as we can tell, and of course we can't see into people's hearts across this distance and on the basis of available sources, often to escape extenuating, very difficult circumstances within the Jewish community, or just difficult circumstances of life. Could be bankruptcy, could be social tensions, could just be poverty. There are women who converted to escape an abusive marriage. And conversion begins to emerge as a survival strategy in many individual cases, and not as a response to Christian pressure. Of course, it was available because there was a desire on the part of the church to gain Jewish converts, but not as a response, say, to conversionary preaching and sermons, which were going on during these decades as well. And the other thing I would say about the contribution to the academic study of conversion is that I try to expose the diversity and complexity of Jewish and Christian attitudes toward Jewish conversion during these decades. Because, as I mentioned, the church celebrates Jewish conversions to Christianity as victories for the church, victories for the faith, as confirmations of the truth and superiority of Christianity to Judaism. Yet, at the same time, when one looks at the experiences of actual Jewish converts, run-of-the-mill Jewish converts who didn't become prominent anti-Jewish polemicists, we see that there was deep-seated Christian suspicion of these individuals, who often ended up in a no man's land between two communities that had both ended up rejecting them. And these converts do not receive a warm embrace from the society whose religious leaders professed to encourage Jewish conversion. So there's that complexity. And for the Jewish community, while conversion apostasy to Christianity was absolutely to be avoided and prevented at all costs, there is great division of opinion regarding whether apostates should be brought back into the Jewish fold or not. And again, there is a sense in which it's a great mitzvah to bring back someone who has strayed, and an understanding that fundamentally these individuals are still Jews. But there also seems to be a diversity of opinions, at least popularly. And there are practical considerations which both motivate some Jews to try to bring individual apostates back to Judaism. For example, it's with somebody from your family, a dear friend, not only ideological reasons, but also fear of these individuals who had betrayed the Jewish community and who were known to often denounce Jews to Christian authorities on charges of anti-Christian behavior. And even in the best of cases, say from a Jewish perspective, where there was an apostate who was truly repentant and wholeheartedly wanted to return to the Jewish fold, doing so, participating in helping somebody return to Judaism, endangered that Jewish community, because that was a capital crime from the perspective of the church. And so it put everybody at risk. And so we see that this is a sort of a controversial topic among Jews at this time, and that the question of conversion, therefore, is something that is in the mix in the context of Jewish-Christian tensions 150 years plus before the period in which we're used to considering these issues in Spain.
What do you mean by the term conversion as escape? Can you explain the concept?
Sure. I mean, conversion as a last resort for a Jew in dire straits who sees perhaps no other way of trying to improve their life. The idea that in some cases, well, the grass must be greener on the other side of the fields. Or let's say one is bankrupt or very impoverished, and internal Jewish charitable mechanisms due to famine, plague, and other developments of the period might be depleted. One might think, well, at least if I'm baptized, then I'll have access to the far greater range of Christian charitable institutions. There are also more dramatic instances in which Jews who had been sentenced to a harsh punishment by Christian authorities hoped, and sometimes they were right, that if they accepted baptism, the Christian authorities would remove that penalty to show how supportive they were of Jewish conversion. And so you could literally escape potentially a death penalty or death by hanging from your feet between two rabid dogs, which is how one might be put to death as a professing Jew, maybe just be hung the normal way as though that weren't horrific, through baptism. So I call these and other scenarios instances of conversion as escape, as opposed to conversion for the sake of embracing something for which one longs or in which one believes. And I'm not ruling out the possibility. It's not possible for me as a historian to say what did and did not happen for sure. But conversion as escape is the phenomenon that became really prominent through examining the sources that I worked with.
How did baptisms of Jews transpire and unfold?
Yes. So here again, what unfurls from available documentation is this great range. There are, even during the period I am studying, violent forced conversions of Jews. For example, during the Shepherd's Crusade in southern France and northern Spain in the 1320s. And in fact, we have published firsthand account of such a violent forced conversion in the records of the Inquisitorial Tribunal of Jacques Fournier. We hear the words of Baruch, who was forcibly converted from Judaism to Christianity very violently in 1320. We also, however, have Jewish conversions that are initiated by Jews who seek baptism for some of the reasons I just mentioned, such that they're not exactly forced, but that's not to say that there isn't duress involved, and it's not to say that they were willing, which is why I very strongly believe that the terms voluntary and involuntary are not always useful in categorizing Jewish conversions. At least when one zooms in, one finds that they only capture the extremes.
On page 107, you write as follows: Jews considered apostasy to Christianity an outrage, not only on account of the nature of Christian beliefs and practices, however, but also because of a long history of Christian abuse of Jews. As we have seen, even though Jews and Christians in the Crown of Aragon often interacted positively, Jews remained epic villains in the eyes of Christians, and relations between the groups were laced with animosity. Jews lived at the mercy of Christians, and Christians taunted and humiliated Jews, spread noxious rumors about them, stoned Jewish quarters during Holy Week, prosecuted Jews for crimes against Christians and the Christian faith, and sometimes even forcibly baptized Jews, heightening Jews' loathing of the sacrament of baptism. Going over to Christianity then could be tantamount to joining the ranks of a cruel oppression. Can you say more about this?
Yes. In the book, I'm on the one hand exploring this world of individuals who at least attempt to cross between Jewish and Christian communities, sometimes first in one direction and then back in the other. And I'm showing in that sense that boundaries could be fluid, although that's probably overstating the case, because we see that it was very difficult to, in fact, become integrated into the other community. But at the same time, the research is in many ways emphasizing the tensions between Jewish and Christian communities, which heighten the significance of Jewish conversion and apostasy for Jews and Christians. Sort of, it's the horror of it to Jews because of what Christianity represents, and also in that context, because of what Christians in many cases have inflicted upon Jews in this historical context. And for Christians, because the Jewish community is persisting in spite of difficult conditions and not converting overwhelmingly at all, posing therefore a challenge to Christian claims of triumph over Judaism, which the church had been making at this point for well over 1,000 years. And so the book is in many ways exploring both movement between communities and contact and exchange, and at the same time, the way all of that is inextricably tied to animosity, pain, suffering, mutual suspicion.
What misconceptions about the Inquisition and the history of the Inquisition does your study aim to challenge?
Right. So my study, I didn't set out trying to challenge things, but as my research developed, I came to find that I was challenging the chronology of how we think about the Inquisition in relation to Jewish affairs, and also the nature of the targets of inquisitors during the late 13th and 14th centuries. So we see inquisitors during the late 13th and especially the 14th centuries, especially in northeastern Spain and southern France, being in fact quite concerned about Jewish affairs. There are over 200 cases in which Jewish converts come before inquisitors in and around the crown of Aragon between 1250 and 1391. The case that I walk through in the first chapter of my book and detail week by week how it unfolded is the only one of those cases whose trial records are fully extant. But we know that there were about 200 such cases. And on at least 70 occasions, unbaptized Jews were denounced to papal inquisitors. And often we don't know what followed those denunciations. So I'm sharing those numbers to give a sense of the scope of the phenomenon that I've been alluding to here, and its importance for sort of rethinking the papal inquisition and the prehistory of the first 50 years of the Spanish Inquisition's operation, which is the period up until about 1530 when the Spanish Inquisition focused on conversos. And in terms of the targets, again, to note that in spite of legal and theological constraints, inquisitors went right ahead, at least in this case from 1340 and 1341, that forms the backbone of my book, and prosecute, imprison, and sentence professing Jews. In fact, one of the three main Jews in Paris case is sentenced to the stake as a repeat offender. He is accused of having already in the past accused another Jewish convert to return to Judaism and burn at the stake as a Jewish martyr. And the two other, two additional Jewish defendants are sentenced to life in prison, and two others disappear and we don't know what happens to them. So in spite of being unbaptized and therefore technically beyond the bounds of inquisitors' jurisdiction. Inquisitors try unbaptized Jews in this period. And in the first chapter of my book, I detail how one such trial unfolded, and we see those Jews turning to the king and turning to communal leaders, asking for help and trying to make arguments that will convince the tribunal that they shouldn't be prosecuted in the way in which they're being prosecuted. And all of this seems to fall on deaf ears and does not help them extricate themselves from this situation.
Should the history of the Inquisition, in your opinion, be considered medieval history or early modern history or both? What is at stake in questions surrounding periodization with respect to the Inquisition?
Beautiful. I often find that chronological boundaries function as blinders that obscure the breadth of patterns as they actually played out in the past. And for that matter, geographic regional boundaries as well, which inform our historiography and the way we teach, of course. So if we think, so the Papal Inquisition tends to be thought of as medieval. It is founded in the 1230s. The Spanish Inquisition, established in 1478, tends to be thought of as early modern. And when we look at those two separately, we miss that procedurally they are essentially identical, and that ideologically they're extremely similar, especially when we're talking about Jews and Jewish converts. It's not just that they're both targeting these groups, especially Jewish converts. For the Spanish Inquisition, it was extremely rare to prosecute unbaptized Jews, although the notorious trial of the Holy Child of Laborda is a glaring exception to that, where Jews and Jewish converts were tried. But we miss the continuities that make it possible to really understand the later institution. And in fact, one thing that was fascinating is that on the inside of the cover of this huge leather codex that contains the records of Pera's case, on the roof of the Archive of Barcelona, there's an inscription that shows that in the 16th century, an inquisitor general named Diego Deza, who was an inquisitor of the Spanish Inquisition, requested a copy of the records of Pera's case from the 1340s. So he had heard of it, that suggests. People were talking about it. People remembered it. And he wanted to learn something for it. So the inquisitors were known as ahead of their time in keeping records. And they would consult the records of earlier cases to learn about precedents, to see how their colleagues had decided to act in certain scenarios in the past. And presumably, Deza was interested to learn more about this case because it was relevant to the work he was doing 200 years later. So there was an awareness that somehow got lost thereafter, between what we now call early modern people who didn't think of themselves as such and medieval people who didn't think of themselves as such, about the continuities in their work.
How did rejudaization unfold?
So Jewish converts to Christianity who sought to return to Judaism did so in a number of ways, depending on their circumstances and whether they themselves were trying to return or they were being pressured to return by Jews. We know from Jewish and Christian sources that often, and more often than we'll ever know, because we only learn about cases when they were intercepted or created some kind of legal dilemma, converts would relocate to a new place where hopefully no one remembered them or knew them, incognito, and try to start life afresh within Jewish communities as though they had never converted to Christianity. That was one way to proceed, which it seems some repentant apostates attempted. But at the other end of the spectrum, we have formal rituals of rejudaization, which Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi wrote about and which Professor Ephraim Kanarfogel is really the expert on, which involved, among other things, ritual immersion, which was understood in a range of ways by medieval Jewish authorities. It was likened to conversion to Judaism. The ritual was very similar. It was also understood in terms of purification from the contamination, the pollution of Christian culture, non-kosher food, baptism. So we also additionally have acts of penance, public penance, enjoined by some Jewish authorities on apostates who seek to return to the Jewish fold. So all of this was exceedingly dangerous. I'm always coming back to the practical consequences in my own research, because if intercepted and detected by Christian authorities, both the converts and the Jews who were facilitating a return to Judaism were liable to be tried and executed for these acts.
You write as follows on pages 94 and 95. Evidence from Northern Europe and Castile indicates commonalities north and southwest of the Crown of Aragon. Christian leaders from England to Castile waxed eloquent about Jewish conversion, enacted laws meant to encourage it, gave charity to converts, served as godparents to converts, and expressed fears about reversion to Judaism. Across these lands too, however, Christian suspicion of converts prevailed. Christians memorialized converts' unique status in writing, and rites of purification and miracle stories developed to counteract concerns about lingering Jewishness. Moreover, in Northern Europe, as in Spain, Jews converted to flee personal predicaments. Some converts became wandering beggars, some sought to harm Jews, some worked as Christian preachers, and some tried to return to Judaism. Deeper exploration of these similarities and of the movement of converts between Northern Europe and Spain promises to contribute to a richer understanding of medieval Jewish conversion and, by extension, of fundamental continuities in the nature of Jewish-Christian relations across medieval Western Christendom. Can you elaborate on this observation?
Yes. So one of the takeaways of this research, which became more clear to me after I finished the book, but I already state in the book, but I developed this theme in an article I published in Speculum a couple years after the book came out, is that Iberian history would benefit and European Jewish history would benefit so much from the integration of Iberian history into the shared picture that historians have developed for other parts of Christendom. For many reasons, the history of the Jews in Spain has been studied and written about and taught separately from the history of the Jews in Ashkenaz. And to be sure, there are many differences, important differences. But there are also patterns that transcended the Pyrenees and that transcended the cultural differences. And many of these have to do with structural similarities pertaining to Jewish life under Christian rule. So medieval Spain is more than half under Christian rule by the early 13th century. And some parts of northeastern Spain were almost always under Christian rule, not under Muslim rule. And in these regions under Christian rule, we see Jewish conversion as participating in many of the same identical even dynamics in terms of Christians wanting it, but being suspicious of actual converts, in terms of Jews turning to conversion to escape hardship, but then having a very hard time living as nominal Christians and trying to return to Judaism, in terms of Jewish communities being divided over how to respond to Jewish converts who might want to return to Judaism. Very similar pictures emerge when one is looking at medieval France, German lands, England, and Spain in these regards. And we lose those continuities or similarities when one brackets regions and looks at them in isolation. So while it's so important to do localized research and to tease out and understand differences, I think it's very salutary periodically to zoom out and say, wait a minute, but what's the bird's eye view? And what did these communities share in terms of these experiences?
What kinds of sources did you rely on in this project? What difficulties did you encounter locating them and interpreting them?
So I straddled a quite diverse source base. Most of the sources are archival documents from archives in northeastern Spain, mostly in Barcelona. So the Diocesan Archive of Barcelona and the Archive of the Cathedral of Barcelona, but I was also working in Zaragoza, in Girona, in Vic, and in Valencia. And these archival documents that might be, for example, letters, missives, correspondence, some of which have been published, some of which have not, between kings, bishops, inquisitors, and others, pose many challenges on the most basic level. Just how do we read the handwriting? What do we do when half a document has been eaten by mold or some kind of insect or is just deteriorating? Highly abbreviated handwritings, languages, Latin, medieval Catalan, and other Romance vernaculars. These letters often offer only a snapshot of a moment in time, leaving the historian to have to resort to conjecture in determining what might have led to this moment and what might have unfolded afterwards as a result of this situation. And so one ends up sometimes with working with these archival documents with many data points, but a lot of uncertainty in how to connect the dots. So that's one type of source I was working with. Para's inquisitorial trial dossier, Codex 126 from the Archive of the Cathedral of Barcelona, was a very different type of archival source because it was a very extensive document, hundreds of folios, where we have content in Latin and in Catalan, and we have witnesses, testimonies, and we have confessions of defendants, and we have inquisitors, consultations with experts, and the final sentence, and all these different pieces, all of which pose their own interpretative challenges. Inquisitorial documents, as is well known, pose great challenges for interpretation, many of which they share with other types of sources. These range from what the historian is reading linguistically might be a translation into Latin of something that someone actually said in a vernacular. So even though things were carefully transcribed by inquisitorial scribes, things are changing through the process of translation inevitably, even in the best case scenario. We have defendants and witnesses who might not be telling the truth because they are trying to save their lives or save the lives of their loved ones. So even if we're getting their actual words or something close to their actual words, that doesn't mean we can take those words at face value. And as far as the words of the inquisitors, it was in their professional interest. And in terms of their beliefs, theologically, it was better to find guilt than to let someone off who might actually have been guilty. Yes, if they're finding many people guilty, then their profession is needed, right, to continue to detect and police heresy. And if someone who is guilty of deviant beliefs and behavior is let go, then in their language, that person could continue infecting and spreading heresy, which would be a greater harm to society and to the world than accidentally punishing someone innocent who, if they were innocent, would go to heaven. And in the end, eternal life was what mattered from their perspective. So we have all kinds of challenges in terms of the inquisitorial material. I also worked with the rabbinic responsa, especially of the Rashba, a communal Jewish leader of Barcelona, and his student Ritva, often in terms of attitudes toward re-Judaizing apostates, efforts to prevent apostasy from the Jewish community in the first place. So to try to bring Jewish perspectives onto some of the phenomena that were primarily emerging from Christian materials at which I was looking.
Since your book's original publication several years ago in 2012 and today 2024, as it comes out in paperback, Has your thinking changed or evolved in any way? Have you come to any new realizations? Have you learned anything new about the subject matter?
Yes, so I somehow keep thinking about the subject matter. And I have, in addition to coming to believe even more deeply and finding more evidence about the importance of examining certain phenomena in broader chronological and geographical perspectives, I've come to think about religious conversion in broader terms as well, even as a social phenomenon. So already in this book, I'm looking at movement in two directions between Judaism and Christianity. I'm looking at Jewish conversion to Christianity, and in some cases, an attempt to return to Judaism. But my second book, which came out in 2020, actually focuses in part on the unlikely topic of conversion to Judaism, of cradle Christians, of people who had no Jewish background. This was very rare. Just want to be clear that I'm not saying that it was anywhere near at all as common as Jewish conversion to Christianity. I've gathered 40 cases from the 13th and 14th centuries, and we know of about 40 cases from the 11th and 12th centuries previously. But this happened as well. It happened for different reasons and had very different power dynamics and implications involved. But I think that there are nevertheless, again, some instructive structural patterns that we can observe when we zoom out of looking only at one aspect of a phenomenon. And conceptually, in this case, we look at conversion to Judaism and Christian, sorry, yeah, not only at Jewish conversion to Christianity, but also at Christian conversion to Judaism. So we see in both cases, converts are pressured to return to their community of origin, their faith of origin. In both cases, there are rituals that formalize return to the original community or faith. And there are other parallels as well. And this is relevant, among other things, to understanding the nature of Jewish-Christian rivalry or competition in this late medieval period and the different arenas socially in which it played out. Sort of in the meanings that were given to these movements between religious communities during this very fraught time. So that's one of the directions in which my thought has evolved or expanded, I would say.
Amazing. As we bring today's dialogue to a close, can you tell us about where your time and attention have gone since completing this work?
Yes. So in addition to publishing that second book in 2020, which is titled Conversion, Circumcision, and Ritual Murder in Medieval Europe, I'm now working on a third book, which again focuses on a single little-known protagonist. So my second book does too. It focuses on a five-year-old boy whom Jews were accused of having kidnapped and circumcised in order to make him a Jew. This is not the case of William of Norwich, whom Jews were accused of ritually crucifying. It's a different case. My third book focuses on a woman whose name was Blanca, who received a begging license from the Bishop of Barcelona in 1371. And this begging license included an incredible story about her alleged miraculous conversion to Christianity. According to this story, while in the throes of labor, after 9 days of laboring to give birth, she called upon the Virgin Mary, thereupon delivered safely, and her baby boy, who was born black, turned white at baptism. So we've got actually two miracles: Blanca's survival and safe delivery, and then the epidermal transformation of her child from black to white at baptism. The record says he was born black as coal. So this is the first known case of a Jew turning from black to white in a story in this period. This trope, however, was quite common in contemporaneous tales about pagans and Muslims. And so this book explores several things. One is the experiences of some 200 Jewish converts to Christianity who lived as wandering beggars around the Pyrenees during the 14th century. and received begging licenses. I'm looking at the miracle stories that were told about them. And I'm especially exploring the relationship between these experiences and stories on the one hand, and contemporaneous models of Christian piety on the other, both for men and for women, which weren't identical. So I'm looking at this gender aspect. And these models of Christian piety emphasized the importance of imitating Christ through the embrace of voluntary poverty. So I'm looking in new ways at story and at poverty, at miracle, and at a contemporaneous trends in Christian piety and the ways these shaped both the ways bishops wrote about converts and the stories that were told about converts, but also the ways converts who were beggars actually presented themselves to audiences of potential Christian donors of alms.
Sounds absolutely remarkable.
Thank you.
Yeah, sounds really tremendous. As we bring today's dialogue to a close, I'm signing off as your host today on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. Today, it has been my hallowed honor to be in dialogue with Paula Tartakoff. She is full professor in the Department of History in the Department of Jewish Studies at Rutgers University. At Rutgers University, she is also the chair of the Department of Jewish Studies. We've been discussing her recently re-released book, Between Christian and Jew, Conversion in the Crown of Aragon, 1250 to 1391, published in Philadelphia by University of Pennsylvania Press, originally in 2012, but newly re-released in paperback 2024. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.